It's really great to see so many people come out and want to engage in a conversation like this around consent, and especially to see so many young people here. So Melissa and I are really excited to get going with the conversation. We've got a lot of ground to cover, so I'll get started on the question. So Melissa, it seems like now is kind of a moment in time around consent. And why do you think that that moment is now, that we're all talking about this issue?
Thanks, Wendy, and thanks for the introduction, Nicole. And hi, everybody, and especially hi to all the young people. It's really lovely to see young people in the audience. I love talking with young people. That's what I've done for 30 years as a doctor. As a doctor who's worked with young people, done research with young people, and written for Dolly magazine, consent has been part of my work and the interactions I have with young people from the beginning. So I just want to make that point that consent is an everyday issue for all of us, whether you're young, old, really tiny, whatever gender you are. It's just an everyday issue. But I think what we're seeing now and what we've seen since January with the naming of the Australian of the Year, Grace Tame, who is a survivor, and that has, I think we've just reached a tipping point in society where these very brave young women, several of them, over the last 2 or 3 years in fact, have come forward, been willing to make public things that have happened to them, and are really leading the charge, actually. And that's why I love working with young people, because it's young people who are the revolutionaries, I think, in society, always have been. But this has taken a number of very brave young women that has just, I think, captured the attention of the public, finally. And so I think that's why we've just had a sort of groundswell. Perhaps it also is, we're still on the crest of the Me Too movement wave, and I think everyone's just going, okay, enough is enough, let's have some conversations about this. I think that's why we're at where we're at now.
So why do you think we've got into such a mess around consent? I mean, really it should be quite simple. You just say no when you mean no. Why do you think we've got into such a difficult space around it?
There's a number of reasons. I think we perhaps keep on associating consent, the word consent, with one thing, and it starts with S, and we have a lot of trouble. It's a three-letter word. We have a lot of trouble talking about sexuality, relationships, intimacy with children and young people. I think that's why we're in a mess. If we could just think that consent is about things that we allow people to do to us, things we allow people allow us to do to them, that has nothing to do with sex, then perhaps we would kind of just chill a little bit more. Because consent starts really from the moment a child is born and goes right through to death. Consent isn't, you know, happens every day in everyday interactions. And we can unpack that a little bit as we go, what I mean by that. I think the reason we're in a mess is because we remain very focused on consent just being around what happens when you hit puberty, the hormones are raging, we start to get interested in dating, in romance, in intimacy. These are natural phenomena that happen to most people. And we kind of freeze up, not quite knowing how to have those conversations with our children. It's difficult in the classroom. It's difficult for doctors as well. Some of the research I've been involved in over the years has been interviewing doctors about the kinds of conversations they have with patients, where it's really important to talk about sex. And they struggle as well. So I think as a society, that's and we're kind of in a mess now because we're realising actually how far out of control things have got, particularly for young people. And I mean, there's always been issues around consent throughout history, but I think we're at a point now where we're going, hang on a second, you know, we need to grapple with gender equality, we need to grapple with sexuality, and we don't quite know how to start.
It's interesting that the conversation is actually being led by young people, that really the impetus for change is really coming from young people saying, you know, this is not how we want to interact. We want more clarity around this. And, you know, I find that really, really encouraging, that it's not something that's being led by adults.
Yeah, and I think that was the absolute privilege of writing for Dolly magazine for 23 years and answering Dolly Doctor questions, because what that gave me insight into was what young people wanted to know. We weren't doing research surveys with them. We weren't sitting in front of them in a doctor's surgery where they might feel quite intimidated being asked very personal questions. These were young people. Most of them were girls, but they were always a few from boys as well over the whole time that Dolly magazine had questions and answers. And these were what young people, anonymously mostly, felt that they wanted to know more about. So I think young people, particularly once, you know, I mean, children as well, but I think what happens when you reach puberty and your brain power changes dramatically, really, start to get really curious about a whole lot of things in the world around them. And so that's what sort of drives the energy, I think, the kind of figuring out, who am I, what do I want, what do I believe in, I'm going to try this, I'm going to try that, I'm going to push back against my parents or my teachers or society. We all went through that phase. So I think that that's why we see often young people leading change in society, and it's really heartening. I mean, I wish, in fact, that we're seeing it with climate change as well, for example. You kind of wish sometimes the older people would also be a little bit more, you know, be a bit more energetic. But young people over history have often led those kinds of changes and those kinds of conversations. And I think we need to respond as adults, caring adults, to those challenges.
So you talked about how difficult, you know, what a mess we'd got into around consent, and how difficult it can be for adults to sort of really express themselves around consent. And it sort of strikes me that assertiveness is very highly correlated with the ability to really truly give consent. And I think that is a problem for lots of people. I know I'm not terribly good at saying no to things, and I think that often we've been socialised, actually, not to say no to things, and I think in particular girls have been socialised to a certain extent not to do that. So what do you think we need to do to address some of those underlying issues around consent?
Well, one, yes, thanks. I guess these conversations around consent often become very gendered. We start to look at gender differences. I just want to say up front that, you know, if we blame the patriarchy, as we've heard a lot in the discourse in the last few months, in my work with young people, it hurts boys and men as well. It's not all just going one way. I think that boys, and I'm being general here, I'm stereotyping a little bit, but in general, we socialise boys to be tough, to not show their feelings, even today, even in the 21st century. I have a son who's 31 now, and I have three daughters, and I tried to socialise them exactly the same way. I don't know if it worked, but I think we tend to, you know, boys grow up thinking, well, you can't always show your feelings, you have to be tough. And so when they get to adolescence and are starting to experience very natural physiological changes of puberty and hormones, and girls are as well, and this was the other insight I had from answering Dolly Doctor questions, was girls get these feelings as well, but they can't talk about them, they can't boast about them, and the way we hear boys sort of feeling that they need to boast about them. So from a young age, you know, there has been this different way of socialising, and boys are taught to be tough and to get what they want, and girls are taught to sort of please. And therefore it becomes really hard in a situation where you're unfamiliar with the territory. You know, you kind of got these nice feelings about somebody, but you're not quite sure. Then I guess the way we've been brought up to think, okay, well, I better please, I better say yes, I don't know how to say no, I think that sort of thing kicks in. So I think to do the right thing around consent with young people, it's about, again, broadening the discussion. It's not all about sex, and we can start teaching children about consent and role modelling it from a very young age.
So we've talked about, you know, how, what sort of a mess we've got into about it. We've talked about, you know, how assertiveness is correlated with it and some of the kind of societal issues that might underlie some of that. But actually, why is consent so important?
Well, I suppose let's ask ourselves what do we mean by consent? What is it? So the dictionary definition, there are a few, but there's a couple, but, you know, it's about permission, giving permission for something to occur or for somebody to have something or do something. It's also an agreement between people that you will do something together. And that can be, you know, going shopping, it can be getting a haircut, it can be lending your younger sibling a t-shirt. It's a whole lot of things every day that we give and receive consent about that we automatically, you know, we don't think about. And we kind of, you know, as when we're raising our children, we teach them how to ask and manners and all those kinds of things. So, in fact, we're role modelling that every day all the time. And I think if we remind ourselves of that and say, well, actually, I'll be a little bit more aware of where consent is kicking in these other situations that aren't quite so awkward for us, that might give us some help. I think that when it comes to adolescence and puberty and, you know, sexuality, I think it's important then for parents and carers and adults, teachers, doctors, to kind of, what I like to do when I'm training, for example, medical students or GPs, is to say, become aware of where your own comfort zone ends. Like, how comfortable are you with your own ideas about sexuality and talking to other people about it, talking to your children about it, and just sort of be more self-aware about that. And so I think, you know, when we're talking about consent tonight, I think we're thinking about sexual consent. But it's no different from consent in any other situation, except that it's about sex. And so that's where the awkwardness kicks in. That's where it becomes difficult. And in the book that Yumi and I wrote, we try to unpack that, you know, sort of with scenarios and examples and step by step, what that looks like and how. It's written for young people, it's written for young adolescents, but I think it's quite handy for parents as well.
I've been fortunate enough to have an early copy of it, and it's a good read for adults as well. And some of the things that I really loved about it was that the book is quite clear that consent isn't just about girls saying yes or no to things, it's also about boys, that consent isn't just about sex. And also, you've got a great section where you give a really good description of what consent actually is and how we ought to understand consent. So, you just want to talk about those five specific things.
So, I think we sort of call them the golden rules of consent. I tend to think of them a little bit as principles, perhaps. But for consent to be valid, for it to occur, it needs to be specific. So you need to know what it is that you're consenting to. And when you consent to one thing, it doesn't automatically mean you consent to the next thing. So if we're thinking about a scenario where there is some intimacy between people, you consent to one part of the intimacy but not the rest. So it's got to be specific. There's an example in the book about lending your little sister your t-shirt. It has to be specific. You can borrow it to wear to school today or to Mufti Day today. No, you can't have it for the whole weekend and take it, you know, on the school camp. So we talk about consent being specific. It has to be voluntary. So you have to be able to give consent. That means you have to be conscious, you have to be sober, you have to understand what it is you're consenting to. And we can go into this later as well, but that's where the law kicks in when we're talking about adolescents and young people, for example, being able to give consent to a doctor. So this is what I see every day when I'm doing my clinical practice, is can this young person actually give consent to this particular treatment or procedure? So it has to be voluntary. You have to be and specific. They also it also has to be enthusiastic. There's this word enthusiastic consent. Personally, I probably prefer the word assertive or confident rather than enthusiastic, because that implies everyone's jumping up and down with joy, which can be the case. But what we mean by enthusiastic consent is that the person giving consent, you know, is really confident that this is what they want to do at this point in time. So those are the first three. Consent can change and can be withdrawn. And that's a really important thing. I think that I have seen young people get, you know, come unstuck a little bit. Not wanting to sort of let someone down, finding it difficult to change your mind, not realising that you can change your mind. That you might have said yes, but actually 5 minutes later you want to stop doing whatever it is, and you can then say, I withdraw my consent. I don't want to do this anymore. It has to be communicated. So most of us communicate verbally, but some people communicate in other ways, and we all communicate non-verbally as well as verbally. So we have to learn the skills to communicate consent. We also need to learn the skills to hear and listen and observe consent. It has to be two-way. So that's kind of the final part of it, is that it's a two-way or three or however many way, multi-way chain of communication. So it's not just, can I do this? Yes, yes you can, end of conversation. It keeps going, it changes, and it has to be a back and forth kind of two-way street.
So I can see that there's lots of young people in the audience today, which is great. But I wondered if you could talk to us about, you did allude to it earlier on, about when we should start talking to our children about consent, and how should we be introducing the topic, because we're clearly not going to be talking about sexual consent when our children are really young.
So as I said, if we think of consent as applying in everyday situations, and then kind of, you know, just as you go about your day, pause every now and again and go, oh, you know, that was an example of where consent was communicated, let's say with a child or with another, with a friend, with a partner. And if you've got younger children, observe yourself and be aware of, actually, this is a consent situation. And perhaps what we could do as adults, parents and carers, is to just take a little bit more time when we're talking to younger children about wanting to do something and asking if that's okay. Now we can get into a bit of a grey area, because of course the younger a child is, the less autonomous they are, the less capable they are of actually completely taking care of themselves and their bodies, and it's up to us as parents and carers to make sure that they're clothed and fed and transported to wherever they need to go. And sometimes they might protest, and we have to work out ways to negotiate that. So it's not a black and white, you know, you must always get clear consent to getting a car to go to school. But it's a thing that, you know, evolves as the child grows older, and we can start to have those conversations. So one example we give in the book is if grandparents come to visit and say, would you like to give grandpa or grandma a hug? Would it be okay if, you know, auntie so-and-so gives you a hug? And actually asking the child, even a young child. We give the example of picking up a baby who can't talk yet and saying, can I give you a cuddle? Now they can't really answer, but you can observe their reaction. So just sort of practicing it in a mindful way with young children, I think is a good, you know, grounding for starting to teach your children about consent as they get older.
I can still remember the horror of being obliged to hug uncles and aunties and things.
I've heard that so many times. Yeah.
Talked about how to talk to young people around consent. And anybody who's got children around can send me. Anybody who's got teenage children, and not casting any aspersions to the teenagers that are in the audience, but all parents will be familiar with the difficulties that there are sometimes in communicating with teenagers generally. And then also when you want to try and have a serious conversation with your teenager about something that really is serious, do you have any advice for people about how they might broach those subjects and how to kind of it's maybe too big a question, but how to kind of create the sort of relationship with your child and then subsequently your teenager so that those types of conversations are possible?
Look, it is a long conversation. I mean, people write books about this, but I'll kind of just make a couple
of
points.
Just a couple of tips that we can take home.
I think that the first thing to know is that, it's completely natural for many adolescents, particularly young adolescents going into middle adolescence. So I'm talking late primary, early high school through to middle high school approximately, for young people to go into their heads. That's just what happens because of what's going on in their brain. Their brains are amazing, doing amazing things at this stage of life and development, and continue to do so, in fact, into the 20s now, we're aware of that. But it's quite common and natural for that to happen. And what's going on for the adolescents at this time is a lot of taking in what's going on around them. And we don't realise that as parents because we see them on their screens or in their bedrooms not being very communicative. Don't stop the conversation. If your child doesn't seem to want to talk to you, it doesn't mean they don't want to talk to you. So that's one thing. I think to have difficult conversations and to bring up tricky subjects, I think I find it very useful in my clinical work, and I'm sure I did this with my own children at this stage as well, is what we call the third person conversation. So asking a more general question about, what have you learnt in school about consent? What have you learnt in school about alcohol? What have you learnt in school about being safe at parties? You know, sort of bringing it in an indirect way. You could ask perhaps about your child's group of friends. And young people in the audience, feel free to correct me at the end of this if you think there's other tips we should be giving your parents and carers. But this is what worked for me and continues to work for me when I consult with young people, is kind of just asking a more generic question about their peer group or their year group. Often using things on the news and things in entertainment media, on social media, as triggers for conversation. One of the responses I sometimes gave when I was answering Dolly Doctor, because sometimes the questioner would say, I can't talk to my mum about this. Or how do I talk to my mum about this or my parents? And I would kind of half jokingly, but not really, quite seriously saying, why don't you show them this this Dolly magazine? You know, show them this and say, hey, let's talk about this. And parents can do that as well, you know. So, on the news there was this story about blah, blah. What do you think about that? The other final tip is sometimes to... because in the home, often it's very easy for a teenager to retreat into their room. They, they have their private space. They want that. They need that. So sometimes if you're walking the dog or if you're driving them to school or to a sporting event or whatever, using that opportunity. I also say to parents, sit down at dinner time together every night if you can and ask how their day was. This isn't just my idea because that's what I did with my kids. It's actually been shown in longitudinal, so research over time with thousands and thousands of adolescents. These are big US studies, that sitting down around a meal once a day, usually dinner time, actually protects young people from a whole lot of harms and bad health outcomes. And it's about building connection, it's about communicating little everyday things. So I think that's another tip, is also just finding space in the day, every day, to just communicate. It might only be for 15 minutes. No phones at the table. All of that kind of thing is also very useful, I think.
when my kids were, right from when they were really small, we always ate dinner all together, and we had this game that we played at the end of the day where everybody had to say three good things about today, which gradually the children hated, but still have reluctantly participated in. And I found that was a good kind of conversation starter. When you were talking about how you start these conversations with young children, you alluded to the issues around autonomy and the autonomy of children. And for teenagers and young people, they're in kind of a weird space there, because there's still a lot of things that they're not allowed to do, and that they're not really empowered really to say no to, both at school and at home. And so I wondered if you wanted to talk a little bit about the power balance in or power imbalances that there can sometimes be around consent, and what the difference between consent and rules are, which are obviously an important part of child development as well.
Yeah. So power is a really important it's a really important factor when we're talking about consent. So take me, I'm an old person. I have a power imbalance at my work with my boss, you know, so that exists everywhere where there's power differences, and it can be hard to say no or to know what to do if there's a power imbalance in a negotiation. So with adolescents and young people who are not yet legal adults, so you don't legally have the right to do certain things, but the law also recognises that, particularly during adolescence, that because of these brain changes I keep talking about, that in fact even quite young adolescents certainly have the intellectual and mental capacity to know and consent to a lot more than they did even a year or two earlier. But that's a gradual thing, and it's different for everybody, you know. Puberty and adolescence happens at different ages and different timing for most people. So I think what happens is that parents do have power over their children, and 99% of the time that's completely fine, you know, that's how it is, and children need their parents to have power and authority to help them get places and do things and achieve things. It's when that power gets abused, I suppose, that it becomes a problem. So we talk about power between adolescents or young people and adults. That might be parents and carers, that might be teachers, it might be coaches, it might be employers, as being a really important thing, and the law recognises this as well. So for example, if we talk about sexual consent, if you're in a relationship with someone who has power over you, like a teacher or a coach, then the law is quite different than if you're two young people you know, of similar age. So I think power is really important. The other place where we see power playing out with people who are of similar age would be, as you know, and I remember my own high school years as sort of freaking out because, you know, the popular group kind of had more social power than my group did, for sure. So there was a kind of, you know, that can create a bit of anxiety and tension as well. So sometimes feeling like you had to do things to please a same age peer because they had more kind of social power than you do. And then the other area, of course, is gender. So, and gender, the power differentials when it comes to gender are at all, you know, kind of all ages. So it happens with adults, as we've seen in the media in the last few months, and it happens among young people as well. It can happen.
There was a passage in the book that I found really interesting where you talked about some research that had been done that said that research had shown that when young people are saying no to something, they very rarely actually use the word no. Excuse me. And it struck me that that there's something in there around consent that is about learning to properly listen and not just about learning how to say no. So I wondered if you wanted to expand on that.
Yeah, so we talk in the book about, you know, with communicating consent, there's these sort of cyclical stages: ask, listen, observe. So it goes round and round. You keep asking and you listen and you observe. So it's hard to say no. It's hard to just say no, right? In lots of situations. particularly in a situation that you're a little bit unsure about, a bit unfamiliar, you think you want to do something, but you're not quite sure because you haven't done it before. So it's hard to say no. It's hard to know whether you want to say yes or no. So we talk about consent, you know, just going in small steps. Is it okay if I do this? Yes. Or I don't know. Or if the person sort of says, yeah, you know, kind of listening to the words, but also observing the body language. So that comes back to this idea of enthusiastic consent. So listening to the answer and then observing all the non-verbal communication that goes with that is one of the sort of really important, I guess, techniques around negotiating consent that we talk about in the book.
It often feels to me like the things that we teach young people at school aren't really the things that they need to know. I mean, who's ever been in a lesson at school where we teach children about active listening and how to actually listen to something and how to be assertive and those things, just such important life skills. So, you know, we live in a very multicultural society, and there are obviously some issues around the intersectionality of culture, things like disability. I thought that it was fantastic to see in the book that there was representation of disability in the book. How do you think those things play into issues of consent?
Well, I guess in a way it comes back to this idea of power. So I use this word marginalised. So when Nicole introduced me, she said I work with marginalised young people. What does that mean? So when we talk about marginalisation, we're talking about in society we've got a group of people that have more power, and they tend to be where there's the dominant sort of cultural background, the dominant language, who are able-bodied, and in our society there is, you know, it is men more than women in general who have more power. So when we talk about people becoming more marginalised, so young people, because of they don't yet have full adult legal rights, but their brains are quite adult-like, really, in terms of what they're capable of doing with their brains and thinking and solving problems. So they're kind of in that in-between phase. So young people, I think, on the whole, if they're not yet legal adults, are a bit marginalised because they can engage in adult behaviours, they can be employed, they can work, they can do work that adults have to do, but they can't vote. So there's a bit of marginalisation that happens because you're young. It happens when you're old and your body is frail and you're not as physically able to, you know, look after yourself, you become marginalised. If you have a disability, physical or an intellectual disability, you're further marginalised because you're not in that dominant group that kind of runs the show most of the time. If you're from a cultural or language minority, you are further marginalised. So the young people I work with are homeless, mostly. Most of them are homeless or at risk of homelessness. And there's a lot of what we call intersectionality. So they're homeless, they might be from a cultural minority group, a culturally diverse background, they might be Indigenous, they might be poor. They might be from, you know, generations of people who have been poor. They might have an intellectual disability. They might be gay or lesbian, or they might be gender diverse. So all these things compound their disadvantage and reduces their power in society. So I guess that's what we mean by marginalisation, and it's really important as a human right, as everybody's human right, that we think of all people, and when it comes to consent, everyone has an equal right to bodily autonomy. So no one touching or doing anything to their body without their consent. Doesn't matter if you have a disability. It doesn't matter if your first language is not English and it's difficult to communicate. You have the same right as anybody else to bodily autonomy and to not have anything done without your consent to your body by somebody else. I don't know if I've answered your question, but anyway.
I think so. So we had some questions come in before the event, and quite a lot of them were about related to pornography. So what sort of an impact do you think the easy access to pornography and the fact that for a lot of young people pornography is their first experience of sex actually has had on their understanding of consent and of sexuality generally?
Look, that's a really important question, and I suppose I would start by answering it in saying that we're talking about consent, we're talking about, more specifically, sexual consent. And we've heard from young people, particularly young women, in the last few months, the need for, the demand for sexual consent education in schools. I think that's fabulous. I'm really proud of these young people. I think they're amazing and very brave. I would also say what we actually need is really good, comprehensive sex education. Because if we do that well, we are going to be talking about consent. Consent is a component of that. It underlies, it's fundamental to healthy adulthood, healthy relationships as you get older. Consent is really important. But it is about a broader education and a broader conversation about sexuality more generally. So what's become more concerning over recent years is the fact that because of the internet, because of technology, because of the kind of ubiquity of devices, handheld devices, that young people are coming across pornography. Young people have always, over the ages, adults as well, been interested in different forms of pornography. However, what's happened in more recent years is that it's so readily available. And I just want to quote you a couple of statistics. So a couple of weeks ago, I was talking to a colleague who specialises in this area and does a lot of training for teachers around how to discuss online pornography in the classroom and sex as part of sex education. So some research that she had recently done or been involved with showed that 48% of adolescent boys had seen pornography by the age of 13, and 48% of adolescent girls had by the age of 15. And of that 48%, not all of it was intentional, and their reactions to it were kind of a mixture. Sometimes it was exciting and fun and pleasurable, other times it was quite distressing and made them quite anxious. So what's happening is at a very young age, young people are seeing imagery, moving images of, you know, naked bodies having sex that is completely, you know, it's acting, it's a movie, it's fake, the bodies are fake, the activities are fake. And that might be okay if it was just every now and again. But what the research is showing is that, and I can't remember off the top of my head the statistics here, but some of, you know, quite a lot of the young people in this survey were viewing, viewing online pornography quite regularly, and some of them even felt that they were viewing it compulsively, so they couldn't sort of stop. And they identified it as a problem. Now, the problem when it comes to consent, and I used to answer Dolly Doctor questions before the internet, and before smartphones and things, about, you know, how come it's not like you see it in the movies? So that's where young people used to sometimes get a bit of an idea of what sex looked like from TV shows, from movies. And my answer would always be, you know, that's acting, like it's sort of a certain version of things. It's not like that in real life most of the time. And with pornography, it's far more intense and far more narrow. So we do not see, on the whole, do not see scenarios that depict asking for consent and discussing consent. It's just not sexy enough or something. We also see in what's called mainstream pornography, which I gather is what most of the young people that have done they've done the research on say they see what we call mainstream. So it's very male dominated. And there's certain activities that are occurring that young people report as they experience that as aggressive or even violent. And what's happening is that, again, this survey also showed that on average, young people are seeing this about 2 years before they're even getting anywhere near physical intimacy with a peer. So by that stage, it's kind of getting hardwired in the brain, oh, this is what you're meant to do, this is what it's meant to be like. And then they do it and it's nothing like that. So that's the concern, I think, is that it is the lowering of age at which young people are exposed to it. And there's, you know, we talk about filters on the internet and, you know, changing the laws, and all of that's all well and good. It's not going to stop this kind of tidal wave. That's why I think we need, as adults, as responsible, caring adults, parents, teachers, researchers, politicians, policymakers, we need to be making sure that young people are receiving a much more comprehensive sex education, because that's at the moment where they're learning about what it is, which actually isn't what it is most of the time.
I think a challenge for parents around this whole kind of discourse around sexuality and consent is how you have those conversations, especially when we've got into such a muddle about everything, and you know the impact of pornography is how you have conversations with your young people about sex that actually normalise sexual relationships, that remind people that actually all of the feelings that you're having are completely normal. There are just some things that you need to remember, and that you might need some guidance. And I think that's quite tricky for parents to tread through.
Yeah, and I think it's one of those things where prevention and kind of getting in there early is really helpful, but it's never too late. So when we talk about, and I'll broaden a little bit, talking about more broadly sexuality education, and there's many experts around the world, but in the country that have also, you know, developed resources and do research on this. But we talk about starting from a young age, so children will only understand what they're capable of understanding. So we talk about naming the body parts accurately, not sort of giving body parts nicknames and euphemistic names because we're too embarrassed to actually say what this is. So that's one example where, you know, if we talk about naming body parts and genital parts in the same way that we talk about noses and eyes and ears completely neutrally, that's a good starting point. When children ask, you know, how did I get here, how was I born, where do babies come from, just answering, you know, in a matter-of-fact way, you don't have to go into too much detail. We might observe young children playing sort of games, you know, mothers and fathers or doctors and nurses or those kinds of games, or wanting to get you know, touching their bodies and so on. So rather than making assumptions, oh my goodness, what are they doing? Just it's a natural thing for many children to enjoy physical touch, and that can include touching their private parts, and I will use that euphemism. So rather than sort of demonising it and say, don't do that, that's disgusting, kind of saying, oh, that's something that, you know, that's something that we do in private. Just like, you know, when we go to the toilet, we shut the door, or we do, you know, there are certain things that need to be done in private. So we'll do that, you know, you'll do that in your bedroom. But we kind of overreact and panic and say, don't do that, you shouldn't be doing that. I remember one of my daughters, after school, she must have been in about year four perhaps, and one of her best friends came over and I was at work, so there was an after-school babysitter there, and there was all this drama that happened because the friend's mother came to pick her up and they couldn't be found, and they were in the bedroom with the door shut with their clothes off, and there was this huge panic that, you know, what was going on? And I just said, look, nothing's going on. They're eight, you know, or seven, or however old they were. Don't worry about it. And that was the right call. I think to make a big deal of it kind of introduces something that they're not ready for and they're not up to. So I think thinking about younger children and how to normalise a whole lot of things is a good way to start. Of course, once they get to adolescence and they are becoming interested in what their bodies are doing and how their bodies feel, that can get trickier. But again, I think using this kind of third-person approach, talking about feelings, and I think one thing I haven't yet talked about, which we do go into quite a lot in the book, is to help our children when they're young recognise and be aware of their feelings. Joy, happiness, anger, sadness, jealousy, naming them, understanding them, and then helping them learn what thoughts come with those feelings. So we talk about self-awareness, feelings preceding thinking, preceding behaviour, and that cycle. And that's really the foundation of a lot of the talking therapies, you know, cognitive behavioural therapy and various other therapies and counselling, is about helping people unpack that kind of cycle of feelings, thoughts and behaviours, and how that can lead into problematic behaviours. So we can teach our children that from a young age. If a little one's having a tantrum, you know, not going on and on about it, but just saying, oh, you know, are you sad? Are you feeling angry? How are you feeling? You can say that to a 2 or 3 year old. And helping them learn to identify those feelings from a young age really makes a difference when they get to adolescence, because they're familiar with having those kinds of conversations. Anyway, I think there's lots about that in the book as well.
So before we move on to questions from the floor, in the questions that we received beforehand, there were quite a lot about dating. And obviously, it's often when young people start dating or start those types of interactions with other young people that this whole issue of consent comes into play. So as a kind of final question, what advice would you give young people around dating, boys and girls, to empower them to have relationships in which enthusiastic and properly given consent is possible?
I think that, first of all, experiencing romantic feelings and crushes and attraction and what can happen in the body as your hormones start to increase, you know, it can be very exciting. It can also be a bit scary. So it's quite natural. Not everyone has to feel this way, but it's quite natural for many young adolescents to start to have a crush on someone, to want to, you know, kind of be physically closer to someone, hold their hand or whatever. These are natural phenomena that happen. It probably happened to most of us old people as well when we were young. If it doesn't happen, that doesn't mean there's anything wrong with you. So there's a whole, you know, range of experience that human beings feel. I think as parents, it's actually really, again, it's tricky but important to start having conversations about, you know, feelings. And so, tell me about that boy, you know, what's he like? What are his interests? Like showing interest in them as a human being, not as a potential sexual partner. Because a lot of dating and partnered kinds of behaviours are happening kind of from early puberty for a lot of adolescents, years before, you know, any kind of more sexual activity is going on. There's a whole kind of evolution and development of intimate behaviours that happen that we can have conversations about. And when we decided we wanted to write a book about consent, which was a couple of years ago now, I was very keen, based again from the Dolly Doctor questions really, and my work with young people, that to really have an effect and an impact on consent and the kind of horror stories that we hear about, to try and start to influence that, we need to start way before that. We need to be talking about these earliest feelings of, you know, oh, I want, you know, I really want to be his girlfriend, or I really, you know, I really like that person, I have a crush on this person. So getting in there and helping young people understand why they feel this way, that this is a natural phenomenon for many people, that it's natural to kind of want to pair up a little bit. Sometimes there is a bit of peer pressure around that. We interviewed lots of young people for this book. Some of them were now young adults reflecting back, and some of them were as young as 13. Talking about, you know, this kind of pressure to be paired up in year 6 or year 7. But then when you're actually thinking about dating, sort of partnering up with someone, it's not about sex, but it might be about kissing. So how do you negotiate that? How do you give consent and receive consent to have a kiss with someone? So that's in the book as well. So really trying to target those, I mean, they're kind of sexual because they come with the fact that we're going through puberty and experiencing these new phenomena, but it's not about sort of intercourse yet. We're talking about some of these earlier intimate behaviours. And I think there's a lot that we need to be aware of that we can help our children learn about, either through direct conversation or by using resources. And but then I think when it gets to, you know, I want to go out on a date this weekend with so-and-so, you know, that's where parents and parental, you know, kind of authority and conversations about safety and what, you know, negotiating that. So it's about, it's similar to going to parties. I want to go to a party this weekend. You know, just negotiating some boundaries around that. Having conversations about alcohol at parties is really important for parents to do. And correct me if I'm wrong, young people, but from all the research that and the young people I speak to in my work, that's what they expect of their parents. You know, they don't expect their parents to let them do whatever they like, in fact. That's not particularly helpful for their development. So, but it is a negotiation, and it changes rapidly as they grow up. So when they're younger, when, you know, maybe early to middle high school, you know, these are the rules at home, this is what's expected of you, okay, you want to do this, let's have a negotiation about that, and, you know, continuing those conversations as they grow up.
Thanks, Melissa. I know that when my children were teenagers, they really don't want you to be the cool mum. And we actually had a code word that they would use if they were going to ask me if they could do something that they actually didn't want to do, but they felt pressure to do because it would make them look cool. And then I got to be the horrible mum and say, no, you can't do it. And they got relieved of any embarrassment about not actually wanting to do it. So that was really wonderful advice, Melissa. Lots to think about. And I'm really keen to hear some questions from the floor. And I think we're going to pass my mic around with suitable wiping down between people. Everything's so complicated these days. Are you allowed to touch that one?
Thank you, Melissa, for a very thoughtful presentation. I think it's very important that we consider the feelings of men and boys as well as girls. And I think in this area, we are putting a lot of emphasis on our first. I notice we are overwhelmingly in our group. When I said to my husband, who's frequently with respect for 59 years, that I was coming tonight, as quick as a flash, he said, I'm not coming. And I said, well, I haven't been dreaming. But I do think we sometimes don't consider their views as much. Just an example I'll give you. Girl goes to the shop next door, she's feeling lonely, all her friends have boyfriends, she's feeling like fellowship. They both have a bottle of wine each, he says, we'll come to my room. She comes to her room. She suddenly gets sick and she wants to back off. Now, the guy probably thinks she's given consent by going to his room. He he's also feeling not only physically frustrated, but that he's been treated with contempt. And I think we do have to look at both sides, and I much prefer the emphasis on mutual respect than contempt.
Thank you. That's absolutely agree with you. And you know, as I said earlier, if we look at the way we socialise boys and girls, there is a lot of pressure on boys as well to sort of conquer, to perform, and in the there's a wonderful there's lots of wonderful quotes in the book, but one of the young men that I interviewed, who was 22 at the time, was reflecting back on when he was 13 and 14 at high school, and the enormous pressure, he said, that he and his mates felt every single week about what they did on the weekend. And they would make it up. He was convinced that they made it up. He didn't believe a lot of what they said they did. But this sort of pressure to be seen in a certain way as really masculine, really desirable, really in control. And this, I'm talking here about what they, you know, what they did with either their girlfriends or with girls at parties. And of course that completely alienates you if you're gay. But you know, so I think it's, we do have to absolutely, this is about all of us getting on together. It's not about, you know, pitting girls against boys. And I would, you know, in the few questions that would come through from boys to Dolly Doctor, it wasn't, they were not questions, these were unsolicited questions. They were not about, kind of, why wouldn't she let me do this to her? They were about, how do I be a better partner? I guess they didn't put it like that. I feel anxious about, what's expected of me. I feel anxious about my body image. These were the sorts of questions that boys would send me, but they would probably never be able to ask that of a parent or a doctor or a teacher.
Just
I've heard lots of stories from clients in the last 2 years. And my question is,
sorry,
can you just put it closer to your...
Yeah.
That's about it.
...and abuse at these parties.
Mm-hmm.
And how that is really getting in the way of consent.
Mm-hmm.
It is, a lot of times, unsupervised or unsupervised parties.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I think it's both definitely boys and girls, because I really do have talked about this, and they feel this pressure,
mm-hmm.
social pressure.
Yeah.
A lot, my girls are not girls. And there's not a lot of mixing without alcohol. And it just, it's frustrating as a parent that these kids feel like they have to drink so much. Why do they feel like they have to drink so much? They just feel so socially awkward and uncomfortable. And when they get in these unsupervised situations and they're very drunk sometimes, and it just needs to be faster.
Yeah, alcohol is a really thorny issue in our country, and lots of countries, I guess. I guess there's a few things in there. So we do need to, when we talk about consent, we do need to teach everybody, including ourselves, that just because someone is drunk does not give anybody the right to do anything to them. So I think that's sort of number one. But the other issue about alcohol and the amount of alcohol that young people often feel that they have to drink in order to be able to relax and have a good time is a really difficult one. My children were all close together, four of them, and so all in high school at the same time. And I, I had worked with adolescents for about 20 years by this stage, or 15 years. I thought I knew it all. I didn't know anything. I had no idea about how much alcohol was, being, because it had changed from when I was young. It had really changed. And So I was the really unpopular, strict parent. I was the parent who rang every time there was a party, I would ring the other parent and ask about alcohol. And not let them go to the party if, you know, if I couldn't be sure that there would be adults there making sure there was no alcohol being brought in. And I did that till they were, in year 12, like at turning 18, I would check every single time. So I was not popular. But this was at the height of the amount of alcohol young people. It's actually come down. It has come down in the last 10 years, but it's still obviously a major problem. I think parents, you know, parents can do something about this, I think. There are advocates who are trying to, you know, change advertising laws around alcohol just to make it less. It's our fault. It's adults' fault that young people feel they need to drink. They're not kind of discovering it by themselves. They're seeing it all around them. So we all have to do something about this.
Can I just say something?
Oh, sorry.
Is that okay? Yeah. I think that the other thing around that, because we talked about assertiveness earlier, and I think there is something around parents being assertive about setting those boundaries that sometimes we feel uncomfortable, particularly in our interactions with other parents about issues of parenting. That's a very difficult area. I famously sent everybody home from my daughter's 16th birthday party because I discovered that alcohol was there, and I was not popular for doing it, but my daughter was actually tremendously relieved, because she knew that was what I had said. And we also had a dry 18th birthday party for her because she was older than the other people in her year at school. So I said we wouldn't have alcohol, and she accepted that. But sometimes it's about being brave enough to be that parent, you know, and to say to people, I don't want my child to be there if there's going to be alcohol there, and then braving the storm with your child about that to actually get through it. And the thing that I used to say to my kids when I was telling them that they couldn't do something is I used to reflect it back to them. I would say to them, why do you think I'm saying this? Do you think it's because I'm really horrible and I want to ruin your life? Or do you think there is maybe some other reason that I'm saying no to this thing? And although it infuriated them, they were both smart enough to be able to say, well, yeah, I think you're probably doing that because you think it's not safe, or you think it's not whatever that was. And I found that was quite a good way of diffusing some of those sort of conflicts around those things.
Yeah. Sorry, the last part of that question was, where do parents... Yeah, thanks. I'll say about sex education is we're a strange country, you know, because if you look at the curriculum and the syllabus, all the appropriate elements of comprehensive sex education are there. And I'll also just say, for anyone who's worried, that earlier this year I read a journal article that had analysed 30 years of research into the positive effects of comprehensive sex education. And so comprehensive sex education is, as the name implies, comprehensive. I won't go into what that means, but it's got multiple elements to it, and it's backed by whole school policy and facilitating access to services and other resources, as well as giving young people knowledge and skills about sexuality. So that's kind of broadly what comprehensive sex education is. If that is delivered through schools, young people are less likely to have sex young. They're likely to delay it. A bit. less likely to have sexually transmitted infections, less likely to have unwanted or unplanned pregnancies, less likely to have violence in their relationships, more likely to have positive sense of themselves and be sexually healthy. If they're non-heterosexual, more likely to have better mental health, because young people who are gay, lesbian, bisexual, trans or queer suffer far more as they're growing up, and they're very, very marginalised, and there's overwhelming evidence about how much harassment and bullying goes on that we really need to do something about, and that needs to be part of comprehensive sex education as well. So it's got lots of positive benefits. The curriculum and the syllabus in New South Wales is pretty comprehensive. Where it falls down is a couple of places. So the curriculum is very crowded, and if you're the health PD teacher, there are certain things you have to get through in the syllabus in the year or in over the years, and you don't always get, like, it's easy to teach about STIs, because you can talk about microorganisms and communicable diseases, and we're hearing a lot about that in COVID, so, you know, we can do that, that's easy. Or it's easy to talk maybe about contraception and conception. It's much harder to talk about consent and feelings and alcohol and negotiation and diversity. So the teachers feel more skilled and better resourced to teach some of that other stuff. So that's one thing. The other thing is there's just inadequate teacher training at university, and also once they're in the classroom, professional development. Again, it's just competition for time and not having the resources that they need. And the other thing is kind of the community around them. So the parent community and the community not wanting certain things in sex education to be taught. And therefore the school personnel, the principal, the teachers feeling a bit concerned about backlash if that goes ahead. So how do we break through that and say, this is actually really good for young people? You know, it's not going to make them go off and do this stuff. This is actually really good. It's backed by decades and decades of evidence. Other resources that are around are the things that teachers can access as well. So there's a resource called Talk Soon, Talk Often, which was written for parents by someone who was a teacher, who's now a researcher. Her name's Jenny Walsh. It's available online. It's Jenny Walsh, Talk Soon, Talk Often. She was involved in the earliest kind of surveys around the country of young people and students and sexual health. Look, there's a whole lot of good websites I can maybe talk to you about later, or some of them are in the back of the book as well.
Thank you both for tonight. I think it's been, there's so much to cover, and it's just been wonderful to be here tonight. So useful. Thank you so much. I've got two questions. You talk, Melissa, about the importance of a good sex education in schools, and because what I've got two daughters, and sort of what I find is, I think everyone who's here tonight is sort of the worried, well, for want of a better word, but we are trying to have these conversations. We do want to do the right thing for our kids and their friends, but there is a cohort who don't take it seriously. And I think, yes, there are some young men who are wonderful, but there's also a lot of young men who think it's a joke. And so most recently, when we've had these situations with that extraordinary young woman, Chanel, who garnered all those extraordinary accounts from so many people, and so we saw in a lot of schools in this area, and we better get experts in people to talk, but from things that I heard, a lot of young men didn't take that seriously, and laughed and sniggered and thought, that's a joke, and others felt it wasn't relevant to them. So how can we ensure that the message does get through?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, one of my immediate thoughts is the answer's right there. Trying to deal with a crisis by having, whether it's experts, whether it's teachers coming in and talking about it is not effective. It won't be effective. And in fact, one of the things I have said to Yumi and our publisher about the book, because there's been quite a lot of interest in the book, by media and by schools is I won't go in and talk to students in a classroom. That's not effective. That's actually doing a disservice to the young people. I'm happy to talk to parents and their children together. I'm happy to talk to teachers. But coming in and doing one-off, it will be met with sniggers and giggles. And it's again, this socialisation thing, like it's cooler to make a joke of it and to say something maybe a bit derogatory, when in fact inside I would imagine a lot of those boys are going, oh, you know, I wish I actually knew more about this. That's been my experience when I meet young men. And talking to some of the young men that we interviewed for the book is actually that's they really do want this, but they're never going to admit it. So I think it's about, you know, the parents like yourself who are wanting to see change, kind of doing advocacy around that with your school principal, with your whoever is in charge, and saying, we actually want this. How can we support your teachers to teach this better? Yes, by all means, you know, bring in a guest speaker, but it's got to be backed by policy. It's got to be backed by commitment by the principal and the leadership of the school that this is going to change. It's not just a one-off. It's from kindergarten through to year 12, actually. So that's my short answer to that question.
And just the second part of our question is, again, going back to that, the importance of sex education. But, you know, I look at that recent advertising, or not advertising campaign, of the milkshakes to try and, I mean, how ridiculous. And how is it that something like that is commissioned and thought, this is how we're going to educate young people about consent? I mean, what has a milkshake got to do with it?
It's not even worth talking about in a way, is it? I don't know. I felt really angry about the misuse of public funding for that, because it... And we haven't had the answers about how that came to be, like who informed it. I think we have, you know, certainly government, but all of us have a responsibility to give our young people accurate information that is relevant, that will actually teach them skills and knowledge. I haven't heard. I don't know if anyone's heard how that came to be, but I think it's this sort of phobia that we have to really just get in and talk about sex and consent. Like, just do it. It's all right. The sky won't fall in if we do it.
To Rugby Council and to our library for hosting us here. We do have, as I said, resources out there. The library will close at 8 o'clock, so we will start ushering you out probably a few minutes before that, but please take the time. I'm sure Wendy and Melissa will find them in the chat and browse their resources. Thank you so much for coming. Good night.